This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
Welcome to Pax Britannica. Season 3, Episode 24. The Battle of Kentish Nog. Welcome back to Pax Britannica. I'm your host, Dr. Samuel Hume. Before we begin, we have a few new additions to the House of Lords. N.R. Jensen Jones is Earl of Suffolk, Taz Sibley is Earl of Denbigh, Ricardo Tenorio is Earl of Westmoreland, Adam Gibbs is Earl of Winchelsea, Kyle Cricklin is Earl of Shaftesbury, Harry Tassel is Earl of Crawford, and Preston is now Earl of Preston. We've also been joined by Viscountess Marion and Bass Baron Jansen. All patrons get their own premium RSS feed that lets them listen to the podcast without ads. The new Earls can also listen to the bonus content, including the latest episode of The History of the Mughals, which came out a few days ago. It covers the last year of Padishah Baba's life and prepares the ground for his unprepared successor, Humayun. I've also combined the episodes on Baba into an omnibus episode, an omnibaba, if you will, for simpler first-time listening. Go to patreon.com/paxbritannica to find out more. Last time, the First Anglo-Dutch War kicked off, although the winner so far has to be the weather. As Admiral Martin Tromp of the Dutch Navy attempted to destroy the isolated fleet of Sir George Ayscue of the States Navy, the wind suddenly dropped and left both fleets staring at each other. The weather interfered again once Tromp caught up with the main Commonwealth fleet, commanded by Admiral Robert Blake off the Shetland Isles. First, he was becalmed again, then he was shrouded in fog, and when it finally lifted, his fleet was ravaged by a summer storm. Tromp returned to the Netherlands, deeply frustrated, and without a clear victory, he was forced from his position by his political enemies. Back in the English Channel, Sir George Ayscue remained at his post. After his close call with Tromp, his fleet had been reinforced, and he now commanded about 45 ships. He was dispatched west to guard the western approaches and to shepherd the Commonwealth's own merchant fleets, especially the imminently arriving East India Company convoy, as well as some merchants from the Caribbean. He was also, of course, instructed to attack any Dutch vessels he saw. This went quite well for him. 5 EIC ships were escorted to Plymouth, and after prowling off Land's End, Ayscue captured 5 ships, including one French ship. The news of Ayscue's activity made its way to The Hague, and it was deeply concerning. The Netherlands was expecting a very important delivery, which would have to sail up the Channel, and it could not be allowed to fall into English hands. This delivery was an annual payment of silver from Spain. With the 80-year war over, Spain was deeply tied to Dutch merchants, and they financed their purchases with American silver. To protect this shipment, the States General dispatched the admiral I introduced last time, Michiel Adriaanszoon de Ruyter. Michiel de Ruyter had a long history as a sailor and merchant. Born in Zeeland, he'd worked his way up to become captain of a merchant ship, before serving with distinction in the war with Portugal. After this, he'd gone back to being a merchant, and did well enough to retire in his early 40s. Just a few years later, he was recalled to service to fight in the Anglo-Dutch War, and with Tromp's resignation, he came to the fore. Roger describes him as middle-aged and being called out of retirement, which is technically true, I suppose, but it does make it seem like the States General was scraping the barrel, or perhaps a nursing home, to find a good commander. De Ruyter was 10 years younger than Trump, after all, and he was still in his prime. Instead, I think Hainsworth and Churchill put it better. De Ruyter was new and dangerous. He was the, quote, man of the future, as Trump was the man of the past. And De Ruyter will have a long and successful career, in not just the First Anglo-Dutch War, but the second one too. In the here and now, De Ruyter was sent west to protect Dutch shipping generally, and the Silver Convoy in particular, from Ayscue. De Ruyter was shepherding about 60 merchantmen north of Guernsey on the 16th of August, when he spotted the sails of Ayscue's fleet bearing down on them out of Plymouth. De Ruyter was in a tough spot. He'd sent some of his ships off as escorts for merchants, and a lot of his crews were inexperienced. There was at least one collision before the fighting even began, which sank one ship and sent the other one home to repair. Both commanders believed they were outnumbered. De Ruyter, because he knew that most of his ships were merchantmen, not warships, and Ayscue, because he believed that the large VOC ships were warships. Nevertheless, Ayscue threw himself at the enemy, sailing his flagship right into the heart of the Dutch formation. What followed was a very confusing melee. Naval tactics in a pitched battle were limited. Beyond general orders to try and stay together and to support each other, early modern naval battles were more of a pub brawl than an elegant dance. Even so, the English charge had broken whatever limited formation they'd had on the approach. Ayscue's priority was, as always, the valuable merchant ships which De Ruyter was protecting, and chasing them spread his fleet out more than was probably sensible. The Battle of Plymouth was a bloodbath. In the close-range fighting, cannons fired and could not miss. Marksmen had no shortage of targets, and fierce hand-to-hand fighting erupted whenever a boarding action was attempted. Ayscue managed to push through the formation, tack off, and then charge the Dutch again. Neither side lost any ships to capture or destruction, although one English fireship was sunk. Crew losses were higher, though. De Ruyter reported 50 to 60 killed, with another 50 wounded, and the English losses were about the same. An English captain lost his leg to a cannonball, and a Dutch vice commodore apparently survived the fighting, but the stress was too much, and he collapsed and died of a heart attack in the days after. One famous event was when Captain Do Aucs, commanding a merchantman, heard his crew suggest surrendering to the English. To be fair to them, they'd just been bombarded by two broadsides and been rammed by a third ship, and this was not what they'd signed up for. Aucs took their suggestion, considered it, and then drew a pistol and aimed it at the gunpowder magazine. Any more talk of surrender, and he'd blow them all to hell. There was no surrender. The Battle of Plymouth was, in a strategic sense, a win for the Dutch. De Ruyter's objective was to protect the merchants, and he had succeeded. The VOC ships had sailed safely west, and incoming ships had got away east. The battle also displayed trends which were repeated throughout the war. Besides the convoy escaping, which would happen again and again as Dutch warships repeatedly shield the weaker vessels with their own hulls, the different targets for each side's guns were very clear. English rigging was heavily damaged. One ship had cannonballs embedded in all three masts, and more than one ship would have lost its sails if the wind had picked up, because the masts were so damaged that they could easily snap. But English cannon fire had seriously damaged Dutch hulls, in a way that Dutch fire simply hadn't to English hulls. But the Dutch thought it had, and as De Ruyter licked his wounds, he believed the two fleets had been equally matched in firepower. But they hadn't been. For starters, Ayscue had charged in, but many of his other ships were drafted merchantmen, and they'd been hesitant to get stuck into the fight and risk their ships. So in effect, Ayscue's core fleet of purpose-built warships, crewed by veteran sailors, went toe-to-toe with all of De Ruyter's ships at the centre of the fight. Ayscue's ships did need repairs, though, and they sailed off to Plymouth to get them, but none were in danger of sinking. Convinced that the two sides had been equally matched, De Ruyter proposed a bold attack in the days after the Battle of Plymouth, to sail into Plymouth, where the English ships were undertaking repairs, and attack them there. At anchor, laden with building materials, lumber, metal workers, repairmen, and confined to the port and to Plymouth Sound, it would be like shooting fish in a barrel. Even better, with Blake surely on the way back south from the Shetlands, the Dutch could eliminate a large part of the state's navy before they could link up. And so, De Ruyter's ships sailed towards Plymouth, and prepared to destroy Ayscue's entire force. And then, once again, the weather intervened. The wind changed direction, just as De Ruyter was about to launch the attack, and he was forced to call it off. Ayscue doesn't seem to have been aware how close he came to disaster, but the Dutch admiral clearly liked this idea, and he'd carry it with him for another 14 years, ready and waiting for another opportunity like it. For his part, Ayscue would soon retire, or be pushed to retire. He'd been suffering with some kind of illness since his tour of the Caribbean, and he'd spend a pleasant few years at his estate in Weybridge, living off a pension granted to him by a grateful parliament, which included income from the settlement of Ireland. However, Nicholas Rogers suggests that Ayscue was pushed out. He was the last of the old guard, whose service in the navy predated the political crises of the Second Civil War. This meant he was popular and had a base of support within the navy that didn't come from the government. With the rest of the state's navy's commanders being reliable army officers appointed by the Republican regime, Ayscue would never be as trusted. He would return to the English navy after the Restoration, where he'd face an old enemy in the Second Anglo-Dutch War, Michiel de Ruyter. But that is a story for another time.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
For the rest of August, De Ruyter cruised around the channel, collecting Dutch merchant ships as he went and avoiding Robert Blake. Blake had reached the Thames estuary by the 18th of August, and despite sending some ships for a repair, he still commanded at least 72 vessels. The one thing he didn't have was intel. He had no idea what was happening in the channel. He didn't know where Ayscue or De Ruyter was. In fact, he had no idea that De Ruyter was in the field, or that Tromp had been forced out. And he certainly had no idea that there'd already been a battle. For the rest of August, he made his way down the channel, capturing Dutch ships here and there before returning to the Downs. The most recent intelligence suggested that the Dutch Navy was going to launch a major sortie in the next few days, and Blake wanted to be ready. But in the meantime, his fleet would once again become an instrument of foreign policy. If you recall a few episodes ago, I mentioned that the state's navy intervened in the Franco-Spanish War around the Siege of Dunkirk. The undeclared war with the French had been raging for years at this point. Both countries sent out privateers and captured each other's shipping where and when they could. It was part of the reason that the convoy system had been instituted to protect English trade in the Mediterranean. Parallel to this, Anglo-Spanish relations were on the up, and a commercial treaty between the two countries was being drafted in London. The Spanish ambassador, Cardenas, had been informed that a French fleet was due to depart from Le Havre to break the Spanish blockade of Dunkirk. Cardenas therefore requested English aid, since they were becoming such good friends now, to stop this. 2 days later, Blake received his orders. The French squadron of 8 warships and 6 fireships was led by Commodore de Menelay. When Blake's force was spotted, de Menelay raised his flag to show the English that they were not Dutch. Their conflict with the English was undeclared, and surely a lower priority than fighting the Dutch. But Blake continued to bear down on the French squadron, and an attack was obvious. De Menelay had been given strict instructions. Do not get involved in the Anglo-Dutch War, do not fight the English, and retreat if attacked. Well, de Menelay tried to retreat, but the opening broadside of Blake's entire force was more than 200 cannonballs. These smashed into the much smaller squadron, ripping sails and rigging, shattering masts, splintering hulls, and killing many crew. After a few more broadsides, most of the French ships either surrendered or were boarded and captured. Though the supply ships bound for Dunkirk escaped, but would not make it to Dunkirk, nearly all the warships were captured. This included de Menelay's own ship, and he was among the prisoners taken back to England. 300 French sailors had been killed, 500 had been wounded, and at least 1,200 French soldiers, originally destined to garrison Dunkirk, were taken prisoner. Almost all the prisoners were soon sent home, but the officers, and the ships, were kept by the Commonwealth. Shortly after this intervention, Dunkirk fell to the Spanish, and the French begrudgingly came to terms with the English Republic. After Blake had kept himself busy with a bit of light foreign intervention, it was soon time to return to the matter at hand, the Dutch. De Ruyter was still somewhere in the Channel, and Blake had 2 choices. Wait at the Downs, letting William Penn hunt him down and intercept De Ruyter as he made for the Netherlands, or head down the Channel and add his own ships to the search. Blake always preferred action to inaction, and so he entered the Channel. But De Ruyter had been expecting this, and he ably dodged around Penn and Blake and made it home. Then he joined up with his new commander. Who was this new commander? Witte Corneliszoon de Witt, the Vice-Admiral of Holland, had been appointed by the States General to lead its naval war, and I'm pretty sure I got that pronunciation right. De Witt was a talented sailor, a brave and aggressive commander, and a firm statist. These traits had won him the support of the States General. Unfortunately, he was also easy to hate, and everyone did. He was insubordinate to his superiors, rude and egotistical to his peers, and downright ruthless to anyone below him. It was well known that he did not like Tromp, and it was assumed by many that he had had a hand in his rival's downfall. This doesn't seem to have been the case, but Tromp was loved by the sailors. Roger quotes him as being affectionately called Daddy Tromp, and so they hated De Witt. The other issues plaguing the Dutch Navy were still present, and so morale was already incredibly low. But De Witt was confident that he could defeat the States Navy. Despite the warnings from De Ruyter and Tromp and others, De Witt does not seem to have recognised how effective the States Navy's ships were in a fight. The examples given by his colleagues were dismissed. De Ruyter had won his engagement with Ayscue, hadn't he? And Tromp had been surprised at Dover, and Tromp wasn't all that anyway. And if all else failed, De Witt blamed poor leadership and cowardice for previous difficulties. Now he was in command, things would be different. Across the Channel, Blake's fleet was in high spirits. They had plenty of supplies, they were well led, and were on a winning streak. Blake had his fleet anchored off the Goodwin Sands near the Downs, and De Witt was determined to bring him to battle. Blake was also eager for a fight. On the 28th of September, the weather started to cooperate, it's always the weather, and the two fleets barreled towards each other. Again, the disparity in ship size and the number and size of guns really stands out. Very few of De Witt's ships carried more than 40 guns, and nearly all the English cannons were more powerful than those carried by the Dutch. De Witt had brought with him the most heavily armed ship the United Provinces had ever sent to war, and that had a mere 60 guns. In the coming battle, there would be four English ships which outgunned it, and many more which equaled it. The States Navy had the wind gauge, meaning the wind was at their back, and their ships raced towards the Dutch fleet, quote, like schoolboys hastening from school rather than a fleet going into action, describe Churches and Ainsworth. There are times when enthusiasm becomes a liability, and this is one of them. Blake's formation, three groups serving as vanguard, centre and rearguard, lasted only as long as the groups could stay together, and in the headlong rush, the slower ships were left behind. The formation became a jumbled mess. Blake was meant to be in the centre group, but by noon he was at the front, and he reluctantly waited for the rest of his fleet to catch up, with some of the stragglers more than 6 miles away. It was like herding cats, if the shepherd was also a cat who had been forced to take the job. Fortunately for Blake, De Witt was even more disorganised. He'd also attempted to form the three-group formation, and it had taken all morning. He'd also lost several ships who just disappeared after a strong wind scattered the formation, and they didn't come back. So he was now outnumbered. But undaunted, De Witt's plan was to sail past the northern tip of a bank called the Kentish Knock, and then turn about and come down on the pursuing English from their northeast. De Witt could see the opportunity which Blake's passion had given him. He'd done the hard work of dividing up the English fleet, so now De Witt would conquer. But things didn't start out on a good foot. As the fleet prepared to charge the English, De Witt noticed that the Brederode was nearby. This was, of course, the flagship of Tromp, and a powerful vessel in its own right. With Tromp safely on land, De Witt decided to make it his own flagship, for all the advantages that would bring. Except, as he pulled up alongside the Brederode, he was refused permission to board, because this was Tromp's flagship. They were Tromp's men, and De Witt was blamed for the admiral's fall from grace. De Witt, naturally, threw a tantrum at this mutiny. He was their commander, after all. And he was never the kind of personality to take an affront to his pride and honour lightly. But with the English fleet reassembling and his advantage slipping away, now was not the time. He settled for making the Prince Willem, a 44-gun East Indiaman, his flagship, and that was a bad decision. It had a lot of guns, but its captain and crew were inexperienced or drunk. De Witt would find himself spending too much time and energy managing the ship than the fleet in the coming battle. At about 4 p.m, the English fleet moved to engage. Vice Admiral William Penn, leading the vanguard on the James, got himself grounded on the Kentish Knock itself, along with the Sovereign. He'd tried to make space for Blake's group to pass by. Blake wanted to get stuck in. But now most of his vanguard had to slow down, as the James and the Sovereign got themselves free. Meanwhile, Blake and the Dutch were blowing the crap out of each other as they sailed past. The rearguard, commanded by Nehemiah Bourne, arrived at the scene, saw that Penn was grounded and Blake was up to his neck. So Bourne dove right in, aiming to get in front of the Dutch fleet as it sailed south, past Blake and Penn. Once Blake's group sailed past the Dutch position, he turned it around and came at their rear. By this point, Penn had got himself unstuck, and now the vanguard, with their first rates, managed to engage, bombarding De Witt's ships from the side, as Bourne approached them from their front. Making matters worse for De Witt, ships began to desert and pull away from the action. Smaller ships were even sheltering behind their larger comrades, using them as shields from English gunfire, and firing when they had clear shots. Well, mostly when they had clear shots. De Witt complained bitterly that he saw more than one broadside hit friendly ships at point-blank range. The rest of the time, individual guns fired whenever they were reloaded and had a target. It was a different story on ships of the States Navy. Full broadsides were fired at the ringing of the ship's bell, rang only when the ship was in range of a target, and then they were all reloaded and prepared for the next ring of the bell. Not only did the English have more and bigger guns, but they were also more disciplined in using them. The noise must have been deafening. Hundreds of cannons firing in broadsides, explosions, the snapping of wood, the screams of the wounded and the dying. Visibility was poor, with clouds of gun smoke borne from broadsides, hovering over the waves before dispersing into a generalized fog. One observer recorded how the Sovereign, the floating fortress itself, fired a broadside, was illuminated by the barrage, and then faded out of view from the sheer amount of smoke from its guns. Of course, the massive target that she was, the Sovereign took a number of hits. But the observer was pleased to say that, quote, "Blessed by the Lord, she hath sustained no very great loss but in some of her tacklings and some shot in her, which her great bigness is not much prejudiced with," end quote. I was very tempted to call this episode Her Great Bigness. Things were looking very bad for the Dutch. To their north, west and south, enemy ships were firing powerful broadsides into the fleet, and the east was full of smaller ships attempting to escape the carnage. De Witt's rearguard, commanded by Rear Admiral De Wildt, faced the combined firepower of both Blake and Penn's ships. De Wildt's own ship was captured, and he managed to escape and board another, only for an English boarding party to capture that one too, with him still aboard. One Dutch ship exploded as its magazine detonated, killing nearly everyone on board. The Prins Willem took so much damage, as De Wildt was, like Blake, at the front of the battle, that the Admiral had to change ships too. Soon the Dutch fleet fell back, unable to fight any longer, and with night falling both fleets anchored to make their repairs. The next morning the two fleets were still close to each other, about 6 miles apart, and making as many short-term fixes as they could, anything that could keep them fighting, or keep them afloat. Blake, because he was Blake, was ready for round two. He assumed that because the Dutch were still here, and because they had the weather gauge, they were ready for it too. And De Wildt certainly was. De Wildt was always ready for a fight, any fight with anyone. But his council talked sense into him. Even De Ruyter, who was almost as aggressive a commander as De Wildt, pointed out the unfortunate fact. If they fought again, now, with these ships in these conditions, they'd lose, and lose badly. Morale was below the waterline. Their ammunition was low. Many of their captains did not want to fight. After losses in the battle, desertions and disappearances in the night, there were fewer than 50 ships still in the fleet. Blake hadn't lost any ships, and so he outnumbered them even more than he had the previous day. De Wildt raged at the cowardice, as he saw it, of his captains, and especially those he had seen fight so badly the previous day. But he gave the order to sail home. Blake was having none of that. He wanted a fight, and if the Dutch didn't want one, then he really wanted a fight. Most of the bigger English ships were too slow to catch the faster Dutch ones, even without battle damage, but they chased them all afternoon, and English guns had incredible range. De Wildt had placed his larger East Indiaman to the rear, which could better withstand the occasional barrages that came their way. The crew were still just human, though, and though no more ships sank, several more sailors were killed by impacts and splinters. Night fell, and the chase continued in the morning, but Blake eventually had to accept that De Wildt had got away. The shallow waters of the Dutch coast were dangerous to the heavier English ships, and their battle damage made them vulnerable if the weather suddenly turned. He went home, where the crews and their officers were hailed as heroes. The Battle of Kentish Knock was a resounding and conclusive English victory. Or was it? Next time, we'll see how the Commonwealth and the Netherlands react. We'll examine how the Battle of Kentish Knock wasn't as decisive a victory as it first appeared, and how the States General decided that, whether they liked it or not, they needed Martin Daddy Tromp. Thank you to my House of Lords, including the King's Favourite Mike Sanders, the Duke of Bristol, Bill Winkis, the Marquess of Argyll, Bruce Simmons, and the Countess of Shrewsbury, Sonia Mayer. Go to patreon.com/PaxBritannica to join their ranks and listen to the podcast without ads. If you enjoy the podcast, please consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts or recommending it to a friend. For other great podcasts on the Airwave Network, such as The History of China, check out airwavemedia.com. Thank you to Sounds Like an Earful for the interval music in today's episode, to my entire House of Lords, and to you for listening.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Let Mysteries at Midnight be your destination for detective whodunits and captivating mystery stories. You'll hear classic stories like Sherlock Holmes, Agatha Christie's Poirot, and short tales from H.G. Wells, Charles Dickens, Edgar Allan Poe, and others. I'm Christopher, and I read these classic stories in the soothing style of a bedtime story, so you can listen to them in bed when you drift off to sleep. Search for Mysteries at Midnight on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app, and follow and subscribe so you don't miss out on new episodes.